Okay, now for the evening of the 23rd and the early morning hours of the 24th, can you describe the events which you supervised after you were notified of the grounding?
Yes, I got the call 4:25 in the morning, Houston time. That would be 1:25 in the morning. Valdez time, I got the call from Darrell Warner, who's head of Exxon Pipeline Company. He, in turn, had gotten the call from George Nelson, head of Alyeska. I immediately called my boss to let him know what was going on. I then called Harvey Borgen, who is our West Coast fleet manager, and told him to get in touch with the vessel and also to start mobilizing our West Coast response team, which is kind of the first level of response. I then called, and this was an office holiday, so I had to start calling people into the office to exercise and mobilize our own response center in Houston. We did that, and we got people mobilizing the headquarters response team, which is kind of the second level of response. By that time, I had traded calls with George Nelson a couple times, and it was clear that this was a big spill, so we went immediately into the third response level, which is a total Exxon-wide response team. It's called the Interfunctional Response Team. And the third response level, which is a total Exxon-wide response team. It's called the Interfunctional Response Team. And all this had been done by 7:30 in the morning Houston time, say 3 hours, 4:30 Alyeska time. We had already gotten to the third level of mobilization. And at that point, we were moving just as fast as we could to do two things. One was to mobilize all of the equipment that was readily available. Our first source of equipment was the, I believe, Clean Bay stockpile in San Francisco. We asked them to send three skimmers and whatever boom they had available and a whole list of other equipment. We also, and we did that at 3:50 in the morning, Alaska time is when we mobilized Clean Bay. We mobilized the oil spill response stockpile in Southampton, England, of which we are a member. We did that at 4:10 in the morning, Alyeska time. And we told them to bring four skimmers and a whole list of other equipment, communications equipment, and different processes. At the same time, we also mobilized a disperse and spray aircraft, which is on retainer to a group we belong to. That plane was in Florida. We gave it instructions to go to Phoenix and pick up the dispersant spray package. It's called an ADS package, A-D-D-S, and then to fly from Phoenix to Anchorage. We also mobilized and set up a dispersant supply system, moving dispersant from different points in the U.S., Houston, and I believe a couple West Coast stockpiles, to begin to move dispersant to Alaska. At the same time this was going on an equipment basis, we began to mobilize people, two groups of people, Exxon employees who were part of the interfunctional response team, and also experts from the U.S., the U.K., and Canada who were on retainer to us or known to us as experts in different fields. That is part of our response team. We brought Jim O'Brien from, contacted him. He's out of New Orleans. He's a gentleman who eventually took charge of the Cook Inlet spill a few months ago. He was just on his way back from Antarctica, where he had been asked to go and as an advisor to that spill. We took Brent Pryburn out of the UK, who's a leading expert there. And these are oil spill cleanup experts, skimming experts. And we also took Jim Rivera out of San Francisco. And each of them brought three or four or five members of their teams with them. We also notified Rydell, which is a big environmental organization in the Northwest. They sent a team of experts. Once we got all of that mobilized, we then, myself and five people that I picked, took a company plane from Houston to Valdez direct, and we arrived at 5:37 Friday afternoon. There were two groups of people there ahead of us. There were three people who had flown in from the West Coast, Harvey Borgen, Bill Deppe, and Paul Myers. And there were three people who had come in from Exxon's offices in Alaska. So that evening we had 12 people in Valdez. We had another 20 people that evening in Anchorage, but they missed the last plane out for Valdez. You may know you can only get in and out of Valdez on daylight hours. So we had that evening 12 people in Valdez, another 20 that were waiting for daybreak in Anchorage. And we continued thereafter to stream people in. The Clean Bay equipment arrived in Anchorage that Friday evening, and I believe all the equipment from the Southampton stockpile arrived the following day.
So what equipment did you actually have on scene for cleanup by the end of that first day?
We had the, the spray, the first dispersant plane arrived 6 o'clock Saturday morning, so it was in the air. Everybody want to pick midnight Friday as the point in time?
Right.
Midnight Friday, we had the Alyeska equipment, the equipment they had on hand. We had the Clean Bay equipment in Anchorage being deployed to Valdez, and I don't know whether it came in by plane or by truck. I think the skimmers have to go by truck, and one of the things we did, the first thing we did when we got here, was to begin to set up a trucking system from Anchorage to Valdez, and then to set up a feeder airline from Anchorage to Valdez, because all this equipment was coming worldwide in Anchorage, and we had to get it down to Valdez. I think all the skimmers probably went overland, although I'm not sure of that. That's a 7 to 10 hour truck ride, I think. A lot of the smaller equipment kept coming in by Northern Air was our primary contractor for setting up equipment. UK, probably midnight Friday, I imagine the UK equipment was either in the air or was being mobilized to load in London.
Did you have any consultations with the Coast Guard or the state DEC for getting equipment or procedures?
I think we were pretty much blowing and going on our own at that point. We were mobilizing all the equipment and setting up logistics because we realized once we understood the magnitude of the spill, we realized we had to get a hold of all the equipment in the world we could. We went all the way to the Black Sea of Russia to get a large boom. We bought boom or sea barriers from Russia, from Finland, from Norway, from Denmark, from France, the UK. And we were pretty much on our own as far as mobilizing all of that. In the later stages, the Coast Guard helped us with the military aircraft. In the early stages, we were chartering our own military aircraft. We needed the C-141s and the C-5As to move the heavy stuff. And we were doing that on our own. for the first week, and then the Coast Guard took over that liaison with the DOD. The mobilization was massive, and I've heard Admiral Yost in testimony saying that the federal government, he was asked, could the federal government had done the same thing that Exxon did, and his answer was, no way. He said that none of the federal government agencies, including the Department of Defense or the U.S. Coast Guard, could have carried out the mobilization that Exxon did.
Okay. What were the big problems of getting equipment to Valdez?
Well, primarily, you know, you're operating out at the far edge of the world, and once you get it to Anchorage, you're still not there because you have to bring it overland or you have to bring it by feeder airline. Then you have to move it. We were deploying just about everything out of the terminal, Alyeska terminal. Once we got it to the terminal, then we had to move it to the site, and initially that was 25 miles away, but after day three, we were talking 80 to 100 miles away over water. So I think it was probably one of the most arduous tests of a logistic system, or I say logistic system, you got to recognize we started from zero. And we did not have a logistic system in place. We had to mobilize that as we went.
Exxon Shipping President Frank Iorosi testifying in front of the NTSB Safety Board into inquiry into the Exxon Valdez. This is KSK Anchorage, and it's brought to you. This coverage is brought to you by KSK Anchorage and APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.
So, I really had no limits. I had full authority to do anything and everything I had to do to mobilize. There were no limits to my authority, obviously. I had to look forward to some time when I would have to clearly show that all of it made sense because we weren't throwing money around, but that was something to be done much later. I still haven't gotten to that day yet. But there were no bounds. I had a total open authority to do whatever I had to do to get the equipment here.
This may be beyond the scope, but you have any idea right now how much you've obligated for Exxon?
I understand as of last week, early last week, I think it was $92 million as of Monday of last week or something like that. That's just a figure I've heard.
Okay.
That's in cleanup.
Right. What is Exxon's legal limit of financial liability for a spill?
I don't know. It's really a complex subject from what I understand.
Excuse me, Mr. Kancherian.
Yeah.
Mr. Iorosi, can you move the mic back a little? Here we get
okay.
A lot of popping.
Okay.
We'll try that.
That better?
Go ahead, Leon.
You had a lot of problems with logistics or getting gear here.
I wouldn't say we had problems. I'd say we had a lot of challenges.
Okay.
But I think we did everything we could to handle those challenges, and I think in retrospect that was really a outstanding effort on a lot of people's parts.
This has been a very difficult time for people in Prince William Sound. Is there anything that has gone good for you in this response operation?
We had three challenges when we arrived in Valdez Friday night. We had 240,000 barrels of oil on the water, or I think the final figure is 258,000 barrels oil on the water. We had another 1 million barrels in a damaged ship, and the assessment I received, the first technical assessment of the condition of the vessel when I arrived, and that came from our technical office in New Jersey, and their evaluation was that if the ship slipped off that reef, it was likely to capsize. So, of course, that greatly increased our anxiety. We had 1 million barrels in the ship. At this point, we had 30 or 40 people on the ship. That was our second challenge, and then, of course, we knew even when we got the oil off, we had the third challenge, which was how to get the ship off the reef, because it was still going to have 600,000 barrels of oily water on it. So we had those three major challenges. I understand that, you know, it's hard to rate myself. I understand that Secretary Skinner of the Department of Transportation was asked to rate our mobilization, and he said he'd give it an A to A plus. So mobilization was a clear plus. We got the million barrels off the ship without spilling a drop of it, so I would say that that was a clear plus. It took a lot of heroics on a lot of people's parts. You've talked to most of our crew over the past couple days, and I have to tell you, they did an absolutely miraculous job under very, very difficult circumstances, but they stuck with it. They, along with a few others, were, I think, the real heroes in getting that million barrels off. As far as a third challenge, getting the ship off the reef, I would say we probably, if we don't rate 100, it's probably 99 as far as doing that. The one clear thing we were not able to do, and I'm not sure there was a power on earth that could do it, but that was recover the 240,000 barrels that had already spilled.
When did Exxon officially take over the response to the spill?
It happened in phases. When we got here Friday night, two of my people, Harvey Borgen and Craig Rassinier, began working with Alyeska. At that point, Friday night, we took over the first couple phases of the response. We took over lightering. We took over dispersion approvals. We took over salvage studies, and we took over community involvement and press involvement. Then during the course of the next day, we took over just about all of the other activities. Craig and Harvey had a overflight with the Alyeska people, first light Saturday morning. By 12 o'clock, we had our operations center manned. We had all the telephones we needed at the time, and we began to take on different parts of the oil spill response activity. And by evening, we had taken over full decision-making and control of the response, except for certain activities that Alyeska was very much involved with. They continued their operations center. This was deploying boats and things like that. That at that point, they were acting as part of our response activity, and they continued to act in those particular areas where they had total control of it.
Okay, I just want to wrap up a few questions. Do you have any perception of the Coast Guard BTS operation?
Just what I've heard in the past couple weeks.
Have you ever given any orders or directives to the vessels leaving or entering Valdez to slow down for ice or wait for daylight operation?
Not to my knowledge. I don't know of any.
Get back to Captain
Hayes. That decision-making always rests in the hands of the master.
Okay. Get back to Captain Hazelwood. Do you know why he was assigned to the Valdez?
No. That was part of an activity. I think there was a general, as I recall, it was associated with the movement of the vessel he had been on from the Gulf Coast to the West Coast. And at that time, the ship group coordinators made a decision on how to shuffle masters and what masters would best fit which trades.
Are you aware of his relative rank with the other masters in Exxon?
I believe he's average performer if you take it on an overall basis. He has some outstanding qualities and skills, as I understand it, professional and technical skills. I don't have any direct knowledge of his performance.
What about his, how does he rate compared to his counterparts on the Long Beach?
I don't know.
That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Dr. Berkey?
Could we give the witness Exhibit 5H and 5J, please?
Certainly.
On the witness stand now is Frank Iarossi, president of Exxon Shipping Company. He's about to be questioned by Dr. Merritt Berkey, who's the toxicology specialist with the National Transportation Safety Board. This is live coverage of the NTSB hearings in Anchorage, brought to you by KSKA Anchorage and APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network. To recap so far, Mr. Iarossi has repeated a story he's told many times now since the grounding of the Exxon Valdez. He testified in a very similar manner to a congressional hearing, the chronology of events. Let's go back to the hearing now.
Policies that I think you had some hand in, I believe. At
yes.
least I see a signature of yours in that document. Can you tell us when this policy went into effect and the circumstances that brought this policy?
The policy on alcoholism, I think, goes all the way back to 1977. This is, I think, a major update that took place in 86 or 87. I'm not sure. There have been different upgradings and variations of the policy.
Is there any particular circumstance that brought this about?
I think the original policy back in 77 was alcohol-related, and this policy was in response to concerns about drug abuse as well as alcohol. So the policy was expanded and modified in certain areas.
Could you just very briefly summarize what this policy is in terms of addressing the problem of alcohol abuse and drugs?
Well, the starting from, and this goes way back, an absolute prohibition on possession or use of alcohol, and now it's alcohol and illegal drugs on board any company facility, including our tugs and barges and tankers. And also an absolute prohibition on anyone being unfit for duty at any time because of the use of misuse of alcohol or illegal drugs. That's one facet of the policy, and clearly the penalty for violating that policy through the years has gotten tougher and tougher, and now it's an outright termination. It has been that way for a number of years. The second part of this was a alcohol drug rehabilitation program. It was really in two parts. The rehabilitation program was aimed at trying to get people to recognize their problems and agree to undergo on a voluntary basis rehabilitation.
Does Exxon have a training program in which this policy is part of that curriculum?
I believe we've handled it at different times through the fleet officers conferences that I spoke of. We also have had a number of letters to employees, one in August of 85, another in March of 87, and another in September of 88, going directly to each employee, explaining the different parts of the program, what sort of help was available to him or her, and also explaining again what the policy was and what the penalty would be for violations of it.
On page one of that document, it refers to unannounced searches on vessels. Has Exxon ever done such a search? And if so, by whom? Under what circumstances?
We initiated a very aggressive drug and alcohol search program in 1982. In the past 6.5 years, we've had 30 of our ocean tankers go through a very rigorous drug and alcohol search. We use contract inspectors and trained dogs in the search. They have total access to the full vessel, also to the employees. At times, we've used customs agents rather than contract people, particularly if the vessel had left Panama in the Valdez trade prior to early this year. Some of our vessels would go down to Panama, and then other vessels would pick up oil on the Gulf side of Panama and move it into our U.S. refineries. So we had a number of ships transiting in and out of Panama. So for those vessels, we would usually ask the Customs Service if they had agents available to carry out the search. If they did not, then we'd go to contract inspectors and trained dogs. If we were had a search on a vessel which was not in Panama trade, then we would go directly to contract agencies and their trained dogs. So in 6.5 years, we've had 30 searches, and I guess that's about five of these searches a year on average. And that represents about 25% to 30% of our operating vessels in any given year, which is why I say it was an aggressive program, is an aggressive program.
Have you ever dismissed an individual on your vessel's license or otherwise because of the use of alcohol or drugs or finding of alcohol and drugs on board the vessels?
Yes, in the past 5 years, we have had 55 disciplinary cases as a result of violations of the drug and alcohol policy. 34 of those 55 cases resulted in terminations. The employee was fired. Five of those 34 cases was challenged by our unlicensed union. We went to arbitration, and in those five cases, the arbitrators ruled or overruled the company. The position that the arbitrators took in those cases was that the company's termination policy was too severe, and we had to rehire those employees. That was five of the 34.
On page two of exhibit 5I, on paragraph one, item numbered one there, who is to do the searches of the vessels for alcohol and or drugs?
5I is the Sea Carrier Initiative?
Yes.
In that case, where the masters make the searches, and these the Sea Carrier Initiative covers vessels coming from a foreign port to the U.S., and in that case, the master is required to make a search prior to the vessel's departure or to initiate a search, and then also once during the voyage.
So this would not apply to a vessel like the Valdez leaving Alaska and going to a port in the United States?
I don't believe so. The Sea Carrier Initiative is an agreement with the U.S. Customs Service, and I believe it impacts those vessels on foreign voyage, foreign port to U.S.
So how would a vessel like the Exxon Valdez, how would you implement that drug and alcohol policy?
We would, at different intervals through the year, the fleet manager would, or either I would initiate it or the fleet manager would initiate a search of a vessel, or I would ask him to pick one of his vessels either coming up from Panama or coming out from Valdez. We usually kept that designation very, very confidential, and the only people who knew about an intended search would be myself, the fleet manager, and the responsible ship group coordinator, who would then contract or contact the agency which would carry out the search. This is a full search using dogs and trained inspectors. The master at any time has the right. Our masters have the right to search for cause if they believe there's any reason to do that.
Was this ever done in a vessel in the last 2 years?
Search for cause?
No, a search, unannounced search generated from outside the vessel master authority.
Oh yeah, the 30 searches over the past 6.5 years, they were all generated from shoreside.
When did you, Exxon Shipping Corporation, know about Captain Hazelwood's chemical dependency problem?
I believe our first knowledge of it was in May of 85, after he had completed the program. It was a unique situation. Normally,
excuse me, may I interrupt you for just a minute? When you say completed a program, I'm not sure what you're referring to.
I believe he had already been through the intern phase of the rehabilitation in May of 85.
Was that through your EAP program?
The EHAP program, which is currently in place, I don't believe was in place in 1985. I think this is a more recent version.
How did you become aware of that after he got out?
We learned through, I think it was just by chance, the administrative manager had been trying to get a hold of Captain Hazelwood, as I remember it, and had learned that he was in a hospital in New York, Long Island, I believe it was, and tracing it down, came across this situation.
Had no one else reported it to upper management that there was a problem?
That's the first I heard of it, when the administrative manager told me about it.
I'll ask the question again. Had that been reported prior to his going into a rehabilitation program to upper management?
Not to my knowledge. Normally, that program is totally confidential, and we wouldn't even hear anything about it.
That program being the one Captain Hazelwood selected?
The EHAP program that we currently have is totally confidential.
I understand that. That was not in existence, was it not, at the time of 85, when Captain Hazelwood apparently checked himself into a rehab program?
There was a policy at that time, and I think that policy also guaranteed confidentiality.
That was an Exxon policy?
That was the Exxon policy going back to 1977, yes. I think any records that came out of voluntary rehabilitation were confidential.
What happened at Exxon when this information came to your knowledge in, I believe you said, in March of 85?
May of 85.
May of 85.
It was either late May or early June of 1985. Well, I asked for the circumstances and found that he had gone through I believe it was a six-week program, and the recommendation after the program was that he go on a 90-day leave of absence, which at the time of this discussion he was on. We went through the policy to determine exactly, this is the first time I had run into it, to understand the policy, to understand the provisions of the policy. I was advised clearly of what the policy was, and that it was a policy which encouraged, first of all, it recognized alcoholism as a treatable illness. It encouraged people to recognize and acknowledge their problem if they had one, and to seek voluntary help. And it guaranteed the individual that his or her job security or future opportunities would not in any way be jeopardized as the result of seeking voluntary help. The words are very specific.
Was a 90-day period granted, leave of absence granted to Captain Hazelwood?
Yes, it had already been when I learned of the situation.
And what followed that?
When he returned, well, the result of the discussions we had at the time I learned about it was that we needed to make sure we set up a monitoring system for his return so that we could, in fact, closely scrutinize his activities, and we did in fact set that up using the fleet manager and the ship group coordinator as the two key people who would interface routinely with Captain Hazelwood.
Who were those two people?
Initially it was Dwight Coops, who at the time was his fleet manager, and Bill Sheehy, who was the ship group coordinator.
And
they visited Hazelwood at about, I think they averaged two-week intervals whenever he was on duty.
And was Captain Hazelwood, when you learned of his dependency and treatment program, was he called to Houston for a conference?
I don't know that. The administrative manager made contact with him. I did not call him to.
Do you, Exxon, have records of this program that was set up to monitor him?
I don't know.
If those exist, could they be provided to us?
Yes, we'll check.
Now, in this program, how long did this supervision or close supervision go on in terms of monitoring Captain Hazelwood?
Right up to his last voyage before the incident.
And that program did not detect his use of alcohol?
No.
Why do you think that was?
I couldn't respond. I had three opportunities myself to see Captain Hazelwood during the fleet managers conferences, which I think one was December of 86, one was April of 87, and the last one was March of 88. At the March 88 conference, his fleet manager, who had then become Harvey Borgen, the Human Resources Manager Dan Paul and myself had an on-purpose meeting to discuss our observations of Captain Hazelwood.
When was this?
This was March of 88. And it was the last opportunity I had to directly partake in discussions of his situation.
During this monitoring of Captain Hazelwood, was knowledge accumulated as to what type of support group he was getting in terms of controlling the use of alcohol, such as attending AA conferences, meetings, and so on?
To my knowledge, part of his rehabilitation was to attend AA meetings when he was at home.
Do you actually know that that happened?
I don't know what the frequency was.
Did you at any time have a complaint or a statement made that Captain Hazelwood was indeed using alcohol?
Absolutely not.
Have there been any charges or disciplinary action taken against individuals who served under Captain Hazelwood who may have reported such?
None to my knowledge, absolutely not.
Would you know if there were?
I certainly believe it would have been called to my attention.
Did Exxon pay for any of the counseling that Captain Hazelwood may have gotten for a dependency or other problem?
I believe we did. Exxon did pay through the disability benefits program for the rehabilitation.
Looking back over that program, that monitoring program that Exxon set up for Captain Hazelwood, would you suggest that there were some flaws in there, or you would do it differently today?
Well, the contact we had with him was while he was on duty, so that meant that we got the opportunity we had to view him was about 6 months of each year, and those contacts were made while he was in port. So the opportunities we had, and to my knowledge, we took advantage of all those opportunities. We were probably talking about maybe 12 times a year. I would say twice a month for the 6 months that he was on duty.
I'm sorry, maybe you can clarify for me. You're saying that twice a year you made contact with?
No, twice a month.
Twice a month, okay.
Which was just about his in-port rotation. In other words, we had opportunities to visit the ship twice a month for the 6 months that he would have been on duty each year.
And that would include twice a month in the past 2 months before the grounding?
Yes.
And did anybody go to, for example, Valdez and see Captain Hazelwood and his behavior and so on when he was not on the vessel?
No.
So you would not know whether he was using alcohol if he was not on the vessel, is that correct?
The contacts we did make with him when he was sailing on the West Coast, I think, were primarily in his discharge ports of San Francisco and L.A. That accounts for the two-week type interval I was talking about.
Do you know if there is any documentation of these reviews and so on as to his capabilities and so on at this time?
I don't know. It's probably in his annual performance reviews, but I don't know that either.
Was his vessel and his quarters ever searched for alcohol unknown to him?
No.
Is that not part of your policy?
Other than these unannounced dog searches, we would only search for cause if we have some reason to believe there was a violation.
Do you know of, well, maybe I should ask a more general question. Are you acquainted with rehabilitation programs?
Not really.
Do you know how long Captain Hazelwood was in a rehabilitation program?
I believe it was 6 weeks. He was an inpatient. And then the 90 days following that, when he was off duty.
I have no further questions. It's
Thank you, Dr. Berkey. I have 12:45. It's a good opportunity to break for lunch. We'll be back at 2 p.m. Thank you, Mr. Iarossi.
You've been listening to Frank Iarossi, president of Exxon Shipping Company, taking questions from members of the National Transportation Safety Board technical panel. And it's been an interesting morning with Iarossi. It turns out that he had known about Hazelwood's drinking problems as far back as 1985. They said that they had became aware that Hazelwood, Captain Joseph Hazelwood of the Exxon Valdez, was in a treatment program. And after he got out of that program, he was granted 90 days leave for follow-up, and that there was a regular evaluation system for monitoring Captain Hazelwood's progress and his status. And in fact, he said that this was the first case like this that he had dealt with. I'm Bruce Mells, with me is Corey Flintoff. Corey, what are your conclusions so far?
Well, I'm not sure, and we'll have to go back and check this, but I think that this is not exactly the way Mr. Iarossi described it during his meetings and news conferences in Valdez. I think this is a little more detail, at the very least, than he gave down there. What I'm saying specifically is I believe he said he knew less about Hazelwood's drinking history than we're hearing here. Also, although there seems to have been a monitoring program of some kind, we're hearing very little about what it actually was. It seems to have been rather insubstantial. Contacts only with Hazelwood when he was on duty, contacts only when he was in port, and only those ports, those West Coast ports like San Francisco and Long Beach, where he would have been presumably close to company officials. So it seems a rather haphazard program, at least based on what we know about it now.
At this time, they also, Exxon does have a strict policy, and he said President Iarossi had actually said that they had conducted 30 searches over the past 5 to 6 years, unannounced searches of vessels. Some of those, they were looking for drugs and alcohol. Said some of those were done on contract, some were done by the U.S. Customs Service, especially tankers that were plying the trade with Panama. They would call in the Customs Service to inspect those vessels. So he called it an aggressive program, said it was about 25% of their tanker fleet per year was being searched, but there were no indication that any ship that Captain Hazelwood had served on had been searched.
Well, as a matter of fact, too, the previous witness, Chief Engineer Jerzy Glowacki, said that in 19 years with Exxon, he had never been searched, and I believe that no ship he'd ever been on had been subject to one of these searches.
And we heard that from other crew members, too. We had Mr. Kagan, who had served 14 years with the company. And so from at least longtime staff people, they were evidently, no one had seen this policy firsthand, at least the very few people who were crew members of the Exxon Valdez. And interestingly enough, when asked about it, and many of them were, they said that they did not even know of vessels that had been searched. So, at least from what they've testified, the word didn't appear to be getting through the system or the network of crew people.
One thing that did come out of the two pieces of testimony that did connect were that Captain Hazelwood had gone through an alcohol rehabilitation program. Part of his monitoring program was to attend Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, at least when he was off duty. And we did hear from the chief engineer, Jerzy Glowacki, today that he was drinking. It's not clear exactly how much, but Glowacki described the morning and afternoon before they went back to the ship and got underway, in which the captain had at least some drinks. Well, he himself wasn't clear that how much. And in response to repeated questions, he said that he didn't think the captain was impaired by alcohol, and they didn't have any lack of confidence in the captain's ability to handle the ship because of it.
He also said that he didn't feel that he was impaired by alcohol. He said that at the Pipeline Club he had 3 gin and tonics, but he also said that, and he said, and we quote, I don't enjoy getting drunk. I don't like to get drunk. And so he said that he didn't feel like his level of operating had been impaired, at least as far as he could discern. And he was, what they found, what he testified, Glowacki, the chief engineer, testified, was that they, in fact, went drinking in 2 different locations. They started out in the afternoon, and then they took a cab down closer to the terminal, went to pick up some pizzas. While they were waiting for the pizzas, they went and had a drink at the bar next door. So, and while they were there, the radio officer, who is not on the witness list and is not scheduled to testify, was also with them and was also drinking. Glowacki testified that Captain Hazelwood was drinking a clear drink. He wasn't sure what it was, said he thought it was vodka.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that by my count, Glowacki said he had about 5 drinks in the course of that afternoon, beginning with a beer at lunch, I think. And the time frame would seem to limit the captain to probably not very much more than that, since Glowacki said that he didn't drink at lunch, and he wasn't clear on how much he drank at the other 2 occasions. So we do have a rather long afternoon up until the time that they departed at, what was it?
About 9 o'clock,
yeah,
or something like that.
A long afternoon with perhaps 5 or 6 drinks in it. It's difficult to gauge exactly how much.
Earlier testimony had said that Captain Hazelwood was late arriving to the vessel, and Glowacki offered some explanation for that, and we heard testimony earlier in the hearings that sort of worked around this issue, but he said that their original understanding was that the ship would be leaving at one time, and then it was an hour later, and then they got there and found out that the time had been changed, and they had moved the scheduled departure time up by an hour.
More testimony earlier this morning on technical aspects that the NTSB investigators have been trying to track down. That was with Lloyd LeCane, the second officer, second mate on the Exxon Valdez, and the officer who's in charge of the vessel's navigation. He was questioned really extensively on the vessel's steering gear, that autopilot that has been suspect throughout. He was questioned on the alarm systems that are supposed to advise the deck officers if the rudder isn't responding to the wheel. He was questioned on ways the autopilot is turned on and off, with the implication that, or the question was whether it would be possible that that equipment could be on when the people on the bridge thought that they were actually hand steering. Not terribly conclusive, except that it seems to have been a very sophisticated system with a lot of redundancy and a lot of fail-safe devices built into it.
One point that did come out is that you could stand at the helm and turn the wheel, and there would be no alarm to go off to indicate that you were in autopilot. So the autopilot could be on. You could think that you were steering the vessel and, in fact, get no response. But we've heard repeated testimony by the third mate, Greg Cousins, by the man who was at the helm, saying that they had shut that off and that the boat should have been responding. At the same time, they also testified that they ordered a bunch of turns and the boat did not respond. And so there's still a lot of mysteries surrounding this autopilot, whether or not it was on and what point it was on and what point it was off. Some other interesting technical issues. In talking with the chief engineer, Jerzy Glowacki, there was one question that was not pursued, but they asked him whether, after the grounding of the Exxon Valdez, whether there was ever an engine order to put the ship in reverse. And he said the answer was no. There was no attempt made to back up, and there was really no follow-up question on that. The board pretty much dropped that. But that's significant because there was some indication from the tapes that the captain was trying to move the vessel, and there was some earlier indications that perhaps he was moving the vessel back and forth. You're listening to coverage, live coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board hearing from Captain Cook in downtown Anchorage. We'll be back. Corey, what time will we be back?
We'll be back at 2 o'clock. This coverage is made possible in part by a contribution from Paddling Into Tomorrow. It's the Bering Sea Expedition by Kayak 1989.
This coverage comes to you from KSK Anchorage and APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.